All right, let's do this. How are you, what the fuckers? What the fuck buddies? What the fucking ears? What the fuck Knicks? What the fucking Alex? What the fuckstables? What the fuckleberry Finns? What the fuck Minister Fours? What the fucking Ucks? This is Mark Maron. This is WTF. Thank you. Thank you for coming by. Thank you for sticking me in your head. I appreciate it. It's a great show today. Denny Tedesco is here. Denny Tedesco. How can I explain Denny Tedesco? Well, he's the son of Tommy Tedesco. Tommy Tedesco was one of the greatest guitar players in the world, one of the great studio musicians, one of the great Los Angeles studio musicians, a master. And most people don't know who he is or who the studio musicians he played with are. They're known as the Wrecking Crew. And Denny has been working on a film, a documentary about his father and those session musicians, Hal Blaine, the drummer, genius, Glenn Campbell, guitar player, one of dozens, it seems. But he's been working on this film since July 1996. Now, this crew of musicians, this was in the 60s, late 50s, almost up until the 70s, maybe a little in the 70s, can't really remember. But this film has won awards at dozens of festivals. But the problem that Denny's been having since 1996 is the film has over $500,000 in licensing fees. And that scared off potential distributors. So between donations and a Kickstarter campaign, Tedesco was able to pay off the licensing for the film. He now has a finished cut, and he's sharing the film with audiences at screenings and festivals as he tries to get it distributed. It's like a lifetime journey. But that being said, if you live in or around Arkansas, he'll be showing the film at the Fayetteville Roots Music Festival on August 28th. But this is one of those movies that just blew my mind when he showed it to me. I mean, these guys, this crew of musicians, I mean, they played behind everyone. The Fifth Dimension, The Association, The Beach Boys, The Byrds, The Captain and Tennille, Carpenter, Cher, The Chipmunks, Nat King Cole, Sam Cooke, The Crystals, Bobby Day, The Defenders, Richard Harris, The Righteous Brothers, Elvis Presley, Harry Nelson, Wayne Newton, Ricky Nelson, The Monkees, Dean Martin, The Mamas and the Papas, Gary Lewis and the Playboys, Jan and Dean, Johnny Rivers, oh my God, The Ronettes, they worked with Phil Spector, Simon and Garfunkel, they were on Mrs. Robinson, Frank Sinatra, Nancy Sinatra, Sonny and Cher, I mean, it is insane. The Ventures, they did the Hawaii Five-0 theme. It's just crazy. And it goes into the whole transition from the sort of jazz pop age into rock and roll and the shift of the focus of the music and how these musicians adjusted to it. It's a brain bending documentary, and it's Denny's life work to honor his father. And he gave me one of his father's solo records, a self released solo record. It's amazing. Just amazing. It's amazing talk about an amazing time, about an amazing bunch of musicians that are really like unsung heroes. They made the music that is in our, you know, that some of it is indelible. It's enmeshed in our memories, in our minds forever. It was fascinating to me. Moving on into tonight's episode of Maron. Tonight's episode of Maron is called The Joke. I directed this episode, and I came up with the story for this episode. I don't know if you know exactly how TV writing works, but we all break stories together, me and the crew of writers, and then we break them down, we figure them out beat by beat, and then someone goes and writes it. Duncan did a great job with this episode, Duncan Birmingham, based on the story of, I go on TV, I go on the Conan O'Brien show, I'm doing panel, and I'm just talking, you know, riffing a little bit, doing some material, and we're just improvising spontaneously, and I do a joke. And it hits me in that moment that didn't feel right. And then I get off of a Conan and I get home and I realize, like, oh, I don't know if that was my joke. If that line, was that my line? Because it just came out spontaneously during a little conversation. But it's really a story. It's one of comedians' biggest fears. It's so stigmatized. It's so horrific, the idea of it. It's a real comics episode about me accidentally doing someone else's line on television. Now, the truth of the matter is this happened to me. And it's been sort of stuck in my heart for years. It was repressed for years. The events of the day that this happened to me. It was in 1997. I was doing Conan O'Brien. Now, at that time, I only did panel. We only did the sit-down talk stuff. Now, the reason that I remembered this and the reason why the episode exists is because, well, look, quite honestly, I had repressed this memory completely. And somebody sent me a link or something to a YouTube video of me on Conan. Now, this video was also on my website. All the Conans are there. They're still there. So there's a YouTube video of me in 1997. And the top of it, it says, you know, Mark Maron steals from Bill Hicks. And I'm like, what? That's ridiculous. And I watch this video and I'm watching it. And as I'm watching it, my guts just start churning and my heart just drops almost out of my ass. And it was like a wave of horror. As if I were remembering child abuse or molestation. It was this repressed memory where I felt just, you know, filthy and violated and awful and like I had done something horrible or something had been done horrible to me. But all the events of that day came back to me. It was really one of the worst days of my life. It was horrific. It was, look, one thing I've never been accused of in my career, and that's being a thief. You know, I've been on Conan 50 times, 50 some odd times. I've put out 4 or 5 CDs. I've done specials. I am hyper vigilant to the point where I barely talk about anything else but myself out of fear of crossing streams. Now, obviously, there's parallel development. There's parallel thinking. You know, shit happens. We're all drawing from the same pool. But it's every comic's biggest fear to do someone else's joke by accident in any context. And it happens. But it happened on television. And it was one of those things where, man, like when I saw that YouTube thing, I was like, oh, my God. And it all came back. And I haven't been able to even talk about it. But we went ahead and based the episode of Maron on it. I directed it, as I said. And I had to get it right. I had to get the emotions of it right. Well, what happened in the real event was I go to do Conan. Now, I talk to the segment producer, Frank Smiley. We go over what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to do my smoking stuff. I'm going to do some other stuff. So you kind of lay it out. And then I get out there with Conan, and I do my shit. I'm doing my smoking bit. And then I tag it with this line that I improvised. Yeah, and it just came out of my mouth. Now, at that point, it was one line. You don't want to be one of those people that's, you know, smoking through a trachea hole saying, I still enjoy it. That was the line. You don't want to be one of those people and the emotion is smoking out of a trachea hole. You know, I still enjoy it. And I just done my bit about lungs whistling or whatever. But I did it. And in that moment, I felt like, ooh, that I felt something jerk inside of me. You know, so I get done with the set and I get in the limo and I'm driving home and I'm like, oh, God, I don't think that's my joke. Now, I didn't know whose it was. But it just didn't feel right. I know it came out of my mouth and I thought of it in that moment, but it didn't feel right. And I'm in the limo home and I'm like, this doesn't fucking feel right. And I get home and I'm like, I'm almost positive it's not my joke. And, you know, I freak out. I'm like, that just came out of me. It's not my joke. So I call Frank Smiley, the segment producer of Conan. And I say, dude, I don't think that one line, the trachea hole thing, I don't think it's my joke. And he's like, yeah, don't worry about it. I'm like, no, I'm worried about it. You know, I don't know whose joke it is, but it doesn't feel like it's mine. I don't think it's mine. I'm going to do some research. And he's like, don't worry about it. It happens all the time. I'm like, yeah, dude, is there any way you can cut it? And he's like, yeah, I don't think so. Let me check. And I'm like, fuck. So I'm spinning around, you know, I'm living in New York City with the woman that became my first wife and I'm freaking out. I'm screaming. I'm like, I don't know what the fuck I'm going to do. I don't know whose joke it is. And I start poking around, you know, other guys who did, you know, who do smoking material. Now, you know, obviously I was a Hicks fan, but I went out of my way not to listen to him too much because he did have a contagious sort of cadence. And I, you know, I think he was an influence on me. But, you know, at that point he'd been dead for a few years and, you know, whatever was embedded in my head, look, I'm poking around trying to figure out whose joke it is. And I come upon the Hicks record. I think I listened to a CD and there's the line. And I'm like, oh, my fucking Christ. So now I'm freaking out. And completely, because it was a complete accident. It happened in an improvised moment, but it happened. It is what it is. So I call Frank Smiley up and I'm like, dude, it's a Hicks joke. It's a line that he did. You know, it's one line. Just take it the fuck out. You got to take it out. All right. And he's like, I can't, man. It's too late. And I'm like, God damn it. And I remember hanging up the phone, and the woman who became my wife, Kim, is there. And I'm like, I'm fucking finished. And I'm screaming. I'm like, what the fuck just happened? How did this fucking happen? And I'm fucking breaking down. And I start crying in my fucking living room. I'm crying because of this thing, this accident. I did this line. I'm crying. And I'm like, I have to quit doing comedy. There was nothing I could do. I have to quit doing comedy. She says, that's ridiculous. I'm like, you don't even get it. You don't even get what's happened here. I fucked up. I did some other guy's line. She's like, so? And I'm like, you don't get it. And I just start crying. And I didn't know what to do. I didn't know how I was going to go out and, you know, and face other comics. I didn't know, you know, I could not. It was unfathomable, the experience of how deep and how awful and how fucking ashamed I was about that mistake, about that accident. Because I didn't do it in my act. It was just stuck in my head somewhere. I liked the joke, I guess, and it popped out, you know, after my smoking bit. Wasn't planned. And I didn't know what to do. And I had to go on with my life, but I was, you know, I was shattered and horrified and guilty. So deeply felt so deeply guilty and ashamed that I did not manage my mind properly. And no one said anything, you know, and I was just completely ready to be taken down for like probably over a year, just to be sort of like, dude, what'd you do? You stole a joke. And I'm like, it just never happened. No one called me on it. And the fact is, I didn't steal it. It was genuinely an accident. It wasn't like I was taking chunks of material. It was just this accident. It was a line that my brain registered as something I liked at one point, and I tagged with it, and there was no putting it back. It was fucking horrendous. And I've never talked about it. And this is the first time I've even talked about it, because this episode is on tonight, and I wanted you to know that it was based on this horrifying, horrifying event in my life that literally feels worse than any childhood trauma that I may have been through. It feels worse, and it still feels horrible that I did that one line by accident in 1997. And I'll tell you, after that, I hyper-vigilant, always hyper-vigilant. We all are, but the shame is still there. And I think that really this tonight's episode, it was sort of an attempt to sort of make it a common experience, at least with other comics, or an exploration of this fear, an exploration of an event that really happened emotionally. But somehow, to forgive myself, because Jesus Christ, I've had a hell of a career since then. But it just stuck in there because it was on me. And that's what happened. And that's what tonight's episode of Marin is based on. It's called The Joke. And it was a very important story for me to tell. And this was a very hard thing for me to talk about. Even though it's almost 20 years ago, it was one line, but it was completely an accident, but it just stuck. It stuck in my heart. And it was, I tell you, man, the shame of the mistake is still there. Like, I should have been able to fucking, you know, just horrifying. Yeah, so Patton reaches out to me, and he's like, Patton Oswalt, he's like, you got to talk to this guy, Danny Tedesco. And I'm like, I got to get up to speed, man.
Right.
You know, it wasn't about, you know, not wanting to do it. It's just I had such a limited understanding of what the Wrecking Crew was. And I knew it was these guys.
Right.
And I knew your dad was, Tommy Tedesco. But I had no real, you know, you got to put it into context. But really,
oh,
just, yeah, but it came down to just watching the movie. And it's oddly, I just watched a Muscle Shoals movie,
right.
And then I watched your movie because Pat Buckle sent it to me. Right. But there was this constant flow of you got to talk to Denny. You got to talk to Denny.
It's like, leave me alone.
Yeah, I was like, all right. I mean, I just got to, you know, this seems like a big topic.
I know. It's like he's dying. It's his bucket wish.
Yeah, right. But no, but it was sort of like they knew it was up my alley.
Right.
But I mean, to really sort of put it into perspective, you got to watch the fucking movie.
Yeah. No, absolutely. No. And the thing is, it's like when Pat was, we were trying to do it, as a live screening too.
Uh-huh.
You know, that's even more fun is when you watch it with a lot of people.
But it's interesting to me that, you know, just as a kid, you know, you're growing up in this thing.
Yeah.
So you grew up in LA.
Yeah.
What, with the Valley?
Yeah.
And
I'm a Valley kid.
And your dad is this, like, I remember seeing Tommy today, because I play guitar. So like from as a kid, I'm buying Guitar Player magazine.
Well, exactly, right.
Right, and Tommy Tedesco was always on the cover. There's always an article about Tommy Tedesco in every fucking guitar magazine.
Yeah.
And he was one of those repeat guys. Like,
yeah,
you know, it was Hendrix, Page, and, you know, Tommy Tedesco. He was always that guy, the jazz, you know, the session dude.
Yeah.
And they always, I remember pictures of him. But I just had no context, you know?
Right.
And then you watch this movie, and it was funny because I talked to this, I can't remember who the hell it was. I said I was going to talk to you, you know, because of the documentary.
Right.
And he says, oh, Jesus, did he finish that?
See, that's the problem I'm having. That's the thing, man. I started this 17 years ago. My dad was, you know, he basically, dad got sick in 95.
Yeah.
And, it, you know, they gave him like a year. I thought, oh, I better jump on this.
Yeah.
And my concern was it was going to be my biggest regret in life is not doing that, you know, telling his story as well as the others. So I started it, and that was 17 years ago.
Right, because there's all this video footage that clearly I was like, is this historical footage? This was shot on like Betamax.
Three-quarter.
Yeah.
I had three-quarter. I had every format except IMAX in this film.
Yeah.
I mean, I was three-quarter inch video. I had 8mm. But that footage, I bought that 8mm footage from the 1950s. My mom shot that.
Yeah. Oh, really?
1952.
With you dancing around in those party scenes.
No, I'm not that old. No, my dad in that band, the first band he ever played with.
Oh, yeah.
It's bizarre.
Well, let's frame it up. So, you know, we sort of moved through it. I mean, when you were a kid, you know, what did you know about your father? I mean, like, he was just a guy, because the interesting thing about the film is that all of them, Hal Blaine, your father, and, you know, I don't have a name.
Carol Kay, Plaz Johnson.
Yeah, those guys, they were working for a living.
Yeah.
That there was no pride invested in the fact that they are on more hit records.
Right.
And we'll go through the list if you have it in the top of your head, that this group of studio musicians was on so many hit records, you know, from the 50s all the way up through the 60s that no one knew about, but their pride level was sort of like, I don't give a shit. We were making money.
Exactly. You know, you nailed it. It's like my dad, you know, he's coming out, you know, these guys are now, they're in the early 80s. So they're coming out of World War II as teenagers.
Yeah.
So they're, you know, depression kids. They're, my God, my dad's getting paid to play guitar.
Yeah.
You know, he was happy as can be.
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, they were, you know, you asked me what it was like growing up as a kid, you know, dad was dad.
Yeah.
It wasn't a good, you know, I didn't see my dad play guitar at home until the 70s.
Really?
And I'm born in 61.
So they had this sort of working class mentality
exactly.
around being a musician. They all had their cabaret cards and they all were in the union.
Yeah.
And they would show up for work. So what were, like, because let's start sort of at the beginning.
Yeah.
What record label were they all at? Was it all
they
Capitol?
Were different. They were different. See, what? No, they were all different because what happened is it was basically the Wrecking Crew. I mean, it's a term that's loosely used. These guys got the name much later, but these guys are, let's say, in the rock and roll at the beginning, early 60s, late 50s. Rock and roll is really not a commodity that everybody's you know, really into.
Right.
Or their labels.
Yeah.
So what they did is, and we only had one track in those recording studios, so they didn't trust the recording groups to make these things because they didn't want to spend money on studio time.
Right.
So they would put these studio musicians in to take the place of bands or record with the singers, whatever, and they knock it out. So what happened is all these different labels, it was after the studio system when they used to be, like, certain guys were on contract with, let's say, NBC or whatever. It was after that.
Okay.
So they're freelancers.
As band members.
whatever you want to call them. Yeah. They're not a set band.
Right.
That's the
but
thing.
But what would a musician be doing under contract for NBC?
Orchestras. Right. You know, the shows.
And,
you know.
And back then, popular music was orchestras.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it was coming out of like, you know, big band.
Exactly.
And like, you know, any... You
know, TV starting up at that point,
sure,
too.
Sure. Right. So they had theme music and they had that background music and they... But it was always a big group. Back then, like if you were in a band, even just for to show up for a dance thing, there was 20 guys.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, okay. So that system breaks down. So you got all these freelance musicians around, and so the studios or the labels would contract out.
Yeah, basically a producer would get a job, you know, he's like, hey, you got a new, this guy, this act, we're gonna go cut a single. So it's all singles business again.
But this is back in the day, you know, of Sinatra, Nat King Cole.
Early 60s, late 50s, right.
So there's no
Those guys, I'm sure, had bigger, you know.
Bigger bands, but it seemed like early on, your father and the people that were involved in what became known as the Wrecking Crew, you know, pop music was more jazz based.
Exactly. Exactly. Now, rock and roll's starting to see, you know, leak in. Now, what's going on there is how these guys are getting their breaks. Because my dad, he's 30. He's still kind of moving into this.
Yeah.
Rock and roll, the older guys aren't going to take it.
Yeah.
Not because they're, some of them, it's bullshit music.
It's a pride thing.
It's a pride thing, but also it's probably, it could have been non-union.
Yeah.
It could have been a demo date.
Yeah.
It could have been, you know, low scale, whatever. But the new guys, they're going to take a chance. Like all of us, we always take that chance on getting the gig.
Yeah.
Well, once they got the gig and once they became hits, like Phil Spector hits, it's over. Now they're in. They're first chair now in that group.
Right. But also it seemed to me that in listening to them, and I don't want to get too ahead of the game, was that they didn't necessarily think they were in.
No. Because, you never.
Right.
All of us. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So I thought that was interesting. Is that, well, so where did your father come from originally?
Niagara Falls, New York.
Niagara Falls?
Yeah.
Have you been there lately?
Oh, please.
You have people there still?
I hope so. I hope they're still listening.
But don't you have family still there?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's rough.
It's rough, dude. I performed there recently. That town, the American side of Niagara Falls, it's depressing.
Yeah.
Like, I did a joke about it. I said, you know, by the time you get through that town, you hope the falls lives up to what it's supposed to do.
Absolutely.
You got to fight the urge to jump over the fucking edge.
Oh, no. It's got, folks in Niagara Falls, you know I love you, but we all know. The problem is, you know, when my parents, both of them, they went to Niagara Falls High School. They met in high school, my mom and dad.
Uh-huh.
That was in the 40s. It was popping, hopping there. Everything was like great. Boom, boom, boom.
The hotels,
And, you know, and it was like, but the problem was the industry, you know, corrupt politicians. I mean, they're everywhere, but these guys were good at it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they decided to destroy everything downtown. We're going to revitalize? I can't remember the term. Well, they never rebuilt.
Mm-hmm.
And then the companies with all these chemical companies just polluted the land. I want in, but if you look across the river, you see Canadian side and it's like hopping. It looks like Little Vegas.
Mm-hmm.
And I've always wanted to do a documentary, The Honeymoon's Over. You know.
So, but your father was on the GI Bill. Did he go to war?
Well, no. No, he was drafted, but they were him and his friends. Now you got to realize Niagara Falls is a bunch of Italians, and fortunately for them, they got all sent to Niagara Falls.
Yeah,
basically.
Yeah,
and it was not Phil Spector, Phil Silvers.
Yeah,
they called it. It was just like that.
Sergeant Bilko.
Sergeant Bilko.
Yeah.
I mean, they were just connivers, anything to get out of work.
But it seemed to me that from the documentary that your father came to guitar late in life as well.
Yeah, well, my mom and I were back east a few months ago in Buffalo. They were honoring him at the museum. And I asked her, and the first time I said, what happened was they went to a prom, like a senior prom in college or something. They were invited to a prom, and my dad went, and my mom and someone said to him, hey, the big band, the Ralph Martiri band's losing their guitar player. And someone said, I know a guitar player. I recommended you. Do you want to? They said, well, have him try out after the dance. And he tried out. And the next thing you know, the next day, he's driving to New York, driving across country with his big band.
Yeah.
Now, and he gets to Dallas.
Whose big band was it?
It was a Ralph Martiri.
Okay.
Big at the time.
Yeah.
So he's going from little town Niagara Falls. Now he's going cross country. He's doing the Hoagie Carmichael show at the Palladium in Hollywood and doing all this stuff. And then they're going to Dallas, and all of a sudden he gets fired with the lead singer. because Ralph Martiri found someone that could play guitar and sing.
Oh.
So he knocked out a guy, part of his you know, salary.
Yeah.
So my father, being a, you know, small town, you know what it's like, is, I don't want to stay here. He went and got my mom and moved to L.A.
That was it. What year?
53. But my question to my mom, I said, did Dad work a lot? Was he working clubs and jazz days?
Yeah.
She said, no. She says, he had maybe a casual, you know, once a couple weeks, maybe twice a month at most.
Yeah. Yeah.
She says he almost didn't go to the dance because he and his trio got a gig in Pennsylvania for a weekend.
Uh-huh.
And he said, I'm not going to the dance. I got a job. And she says, you got to go to the dance. I've spent $35 on this dress. So that dress for $35 changed my life. If he didn't show up for that dance, he would never have the chance to be a guitar player.
Isn't that bizarre? All right, so he comes out here. Like, you know, it's like with these type of interviews, like it's such a broad swath of history. So, you know, Tommy Tedesco, he comes out to L.A. So I thought what was great about the documentary is that they were all very clear that at some point everyone was going to come out here.
Yeah.
This is where music was. This is where it was done. You know, it was leaving New York, the real building, that shit was over.
Yeah.
And it was all coming out here. So all the great players were moving. Everyone was moving here to make a break.
Yeah.
Yeah. So these guys, your father, you know, he didn't know any of these guys.
No.
You know, so when did that start? How does that start?
Well, what happens is like you guys, you start hanging out at the clubs.
Right.
You know, you start meeting people, and that's what he would do. They would do jam sessions, sit in. You know, at first he thought, oh, just put in a resume for a studio musician. You don't do that.
Right.
No one gets a job that way. And that's what it was. You just sit in, and someone would say, hey, man, can you sub for me next week? Like Peggy Lee, for example.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or whoever was, you know, like Howard Roberts gave my dad a break with Peggy Lee. Howard was a phenomenal jazz guy. And he said, hey, can you sub for me?
Yeah.
Now, my dad subbing for Howard was like he was shitting bricks.
Yeah.
Because Howard's like the guy, the king of chords. And, you know, he's a guitar player's guitar player.
Right.
So he always told the stories. So when I'm playing with Peggy Lee, he says, I start playing, and we're playing, and about a minute in, she goes, hey, who are you? And thinking, oh, God, I'm in shit.
Yeah.
And she says, I like him, you know, because what he was doing is playing simple.
Yeah.
Because he couldn't play the shit that Howard could do, you know. But it was that kind of like you kind of break in.
So when he started, so where does he meet? How does this crew, you know, come together? I know they all just work together. But
they start slowly. You know, I think Phil Spector.
Is that where it really started to define itself? Like early on, like he did Peggy Lee sessions. What other sessions did he do?
Well, in those days, early 60s, you had the Phil Spector dates. I mean, the Chipmunks in the late 50s.
He did the Chipmunks?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But anything, you know, singers, you know, any singers at the time that were doing, like Bobby Darin.
Yeah.
We did Wayne Newton, but that's a little later. You know, Don Kashane and all that stuff.
He's on those.
Yeah.
Is he on Mac the Knife?
No. Oh. No, I think that's New York.
Oh, okay. But like, so he was just showing up for these gigs, and they put together the band. And
a contractor puts together the band. Basically, the producer says, so the producer's got the job. Hey, you know, Bobby Darin hires someone. He hires a contractor and says, okay, you know, he calls Hal or Earl Palmer or whoever, and then, you know, starts putting the rhythm section together, whoever's requesting.
Right.
And then he just, you know, they all show up. They don't know who's on the date.
Well, but it's interesting because it was all done, you know, by reading and by, you know, by these were just, you know, go-to guys. They were professional players. They didn't necessarily operate as a unit.
Not at all.
But
they worked so much, it felt like a unit.
But over time, they did develop a rapport. Like because you can't, you know, have that kind of connection. Like the bass player, Carol is her name?
Yeah, Carol Kay.
What an interesting fucking person.
Yeah.
I mean, and it was interesting to me that, like, you don't get... You know, you got a little backstory, obviously, your father and of Hal in terms of, you know, what ultimately happened to them.
Yeah.
But, you know, she suggested a past where it's sort of like, where's the rest of that story?
Yeah, yeah, exactly. There's some deep shit there.
There is.
Yeah. And phenomenal, the fact that she starts off as a guitar player.
But that's it. And also she's a woman.
Yeah. Well, that's it. Yeah. Yeah.
And the fact was that in her story, you know, there were a lot of women musicians in the big band a bit. There was
the big band, right? The string players and this and that, but not in those. In the, like you said, the jazz thing. There were some guitar players like Mary Ford and all those people. But in her position as becomes a bass player, what's extraordinary to me, and this was where I give all of them credit for Carol. Carol's in when they so let's say the. If you're going to put a group together, let's say you got a week rock and roll band.
Right.
All right. The first one that goes is going to be the either the drummer and the bass player.
Right.
Because they got to keep the band going.
Right, right, right.
So for Carol to be in that group, let's say, whatever, to replace someone.
Yeah.
She's not there. She's not a tambourine player. She's not a percussion player. She is driving the band.
Yeah.
As well as the drummer.
Right.
And that's where I go, that's why she's there as a musician. They didn't look at her as a woman. They looked at her as a bass player first. And, you know, so I give them all credit for that. They gave her a lot of shit.
Yeah.
But she gave it back.
Right. And also when she's just riffing, like, you know, when you see like however old Hal was, you know, on drums.
Right.
You know, and then when she picks up a bass. And what was that bass line she played that up with?
Well, she came up with... Wichita Lyman, that opening with which is gorgeous.
Yeah. And, and that they had this capacity.
And the beat goes on.
Yeah, and the beat goes on to improvise, you know, and they all sort of knew each other. Because I realized that with the Muscle Shoals guys too, but they were a tighter unit.
Right.
But, you know, that the core group with, you know, Hal and Carol and your father and
Glenn Campbell. Leon Russell. Don Randy. I mean, they're just.
Who was that other guitar player, the character?
Al Casey?
Yeah.
Is Al Casey. Bill Pittman.
Yeah, Bill Pittman.
They called him King Salt.
Yeah, why?
Because he was so... Rah, 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 rah. He's salty.
Yeah, yeah.
And Hal would say about him was, you know, the greatest thing was he didn't like anything.
Yeah.
He was a true old guy. He was
jazz
like
guy.
Jazz guy. True jazz guy that really hated rock and roll. And they, you know, he would say shit off camera. He'd be in the studio and he'd open up the music and go... Goddamn same old shit.
Yeah.
And how was it? Bill, the mics are on. Shut up. It's like, dude. And the thing is, he was very honest, but unfortunately sometimes too honest.
Yeah.
You know, and you know, what you're talking about is no different than the comedians. You go to work, if they're gonna give you the lines,
yeah.
All right, that's fine. Do you want me to improvise?
Yeah.
Let's improvise first. If you don't like it, we'll go back to the line. And that's what my dad did.
Yeah.
He says, I play for smiles.
Yeah.
If the, you know, I'm going to give him what I think is right. If he doesn't like it, fine. Let's do what you think.
Right, right.
It could be wrong. I think it's stupid.
Right.
But I'll do it. I'm getting paid.
It's also fascinating to just realize that, because this is it's new to me in the nuances of it. You know, obviously I always knew there were studio musicians, but when you really see like the Wrecking Crew or the Muscle Shoals guys, that like they were the ones that made the hits.
Yeah,
that it wasn't like even the Phil Spector stuff. I mean, when some of the footage of them working on that.
Yeah.
When there's like 50 people in the fucking studio.
Yeah,
and they're like and Phil Spector would work them till they were exhausted.
Right, just basically, and some of the guys were, you know, would get pissy.
Yeah,
you know. And. And my father said, I don't give a shit. As long as you keep paying, I'm going to stay here.
I love that. That's the angle. That you, because we all have so much invested in the personalities of rock and roll. You know, like, because I grew up with it.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, you invest in the personality of the performer, the guitar player of like, you know, like, oh, that lead, this lead, and that lead. And then all of a sudden you find out like, holy shit, the Beach Boys didn't do anything.
Yeah.
You know,
well,
the Birds.
Yeah, right.
You know, the Birds didn't. Well, they did.
Well, the Birds did. They didn't do the first one, the Mr. Tambourine Man.
Right.
And that was, again, that was the culture of rock and roll, or not rock and roll, but
music.
Record music in the record business.
Right.
And what happened there was Terry Melcher, who was Doris Day's son, was the producer, and he did whatever.
Also famous in the Manson story.
Yeah, yeah.
I think where
it was his house.
Where Sharon was killed?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And
is he still around?
No, he passed, which is a, you know, there's a few of those people that I spoke to but never got to before they passed.
Uh-huh.
It was a drag. But he was hired by Columbia to do this group, Birds, and he said, all right, fine, but I'm bringing my guys in.
Right.
And they were all pissed off, the Birds. He said, well, I'll use Roger McGuinn because he can play guitar and he can sing, so it'll be somewhat of the Birds. And you guys just sing in the background. So all the guys were pissed off. They don't show up. So he's got Hal Blaine on drums, Bill Pittman, King Salt, Leon Russell on piano, and I want to say Larry Nechtel was on bass, and Jerry Cole, another guy. And they knock it out. And like Roger McGuinn said, he said, we did the A side and the B side in 3 hours.
Yeah.
He says, when we did Turn, Turn, Turn with the actual Birds group, it took 77 takes.
Yeah.
Still a number one hit.
Yeah.
But it's just, but.
It was Terry, efficiency.
It's efficiency. But Terry said, if we don't get a hit, we don't get another chance. And if I'm going to go in there, and it's like a budget again, we're back to, you know, what it is. It's a reality, a budget. And my father always said, hey, you got music and you got the music business. Sometimes they mix. Not always.
Well, you know, your relationship with your father, obviously, you had a lot of time with him.
Yeah.
And, you know, you went into movies and television. That was your thing. But early on, as a kid, did you go down to the sessions? Did you?
No.
Never?
No. Occasionally. The earliest session I remember was Green Acres. And the only reason I remember that day, it was like one of those That's it. And the reason I remember it was because I think it was like five. Mm-hmm. And we were going on vacation or something. And so we all went to the studio and we were all going to leave after that. Mm-hmm. You know, Dad was going to do his gig when we leave. And I just remember Vic Mizzi, the wonderful composer, you know, conducting, throwing his hands and hips up and all that. And I just remember laughing because that's the funniest thing to see a grown man throw his arms up, not knowing he's conducting.
Yeah, yeah.
But that was the earliest. But I asked my mom the same question when I said, when you guys were, you know, again, before kids or before us, I said, did Dad take you, did you ever go to club dates with Mom or with Dad? She said, no. Dad always said a plumber doesn't take his wife to work.
So that's how it's interesting because they all thought that way.
Yeah,
they knew they weren't the stars, and they knew that they were the players, and they really looked at it as an occupation.
Yeah, they knew they were fortunate, and they loved what they did.
Right, right. But still, it was this idea because, like, usually with creative people, as you know and I know,
yeah.
And I think this is indicated in the documentary at the time the business changed, where some sort of notion of authenticity was needed in order to market the music. And I think you sort of suggest in the documentary that
towards the end,
the Monkees were the last bit of that shit.
Yeah,
that when the controversy around the Monkees being a band or not being a band sort of broke, that the market became different because the kids demanded that their musicians play their instruments.
Yeah, and I think the musicians themselves, like, it's funny because I interviewed
Mickey.
No, I love Mickey. But Mickey, his point was he didn't understand the controversy because he felt, I'm an actor.
Yeah.
What controversy? It's a TV show.
And he had to take drum lessons just to be passable.
He was like, so for him, it's like, and his point was if they had put the musicians' names on those records, there would have been no problem. It would have been fine.
Yeah.
I think what happened was there was a backlash against the Monkees, not so much from the public, but internally, I think, from the music community of bands that aren't getting a chance. That was what I felt from him. Because now you got the Monkees being forced down record stores' throats. You got to put this up on the, you know, on the, you're taking shelf space away from someone.
Right.
So now they got this huge thing, the train driving, and they call the Monkees TV show.
Right.
Nobody else has that.
Yeah.
Can you imagine? I mean...
Yeah, right. So some artists felt ripped off in the way of like why they get in the shot.
Exactly.
Yeah. It's interesting, too, that in being sort of someone who doesn't live in that business and noticing this in your documentary and also the Muscle Shoals documentary is that you had these producers. You had these guys who were A&R guys. You had these studio execs that were like, when you talk about hits, like, I don't even get, my brain doesn't even work that way. It's like, well, that's a great album. And that, like, I know that what a hit is, but really on the business side of it is like, we need at least two hits on this fucking record.
Right.
Like, they knew which ones were going to be the hits, and it's almost like the rest of the album was like, we'll see what happens.
Yeah.
But if we get one hit, and when there's only like four labels in the world, and they had all the radio stations, that was millions and millions of dollars.
You're right.
So those guys, you know, some of them had a sense of it. You know, you got Clive Davis, you got Jerry Wexler, you got some of the guys that your old man worked with. Yeah. But these guys were hit makers from that end. They weren't musicians.
No.
But their sensibility was like, this is it.
And they knew how to market.
Uh-huh.
And they knew how to, and that's the thing is you go, people, you know, you compare the business now to then, I mean, you can't compare, it's like apples and oranges. Those days, like you said something, there were only a few radio stations.
Right.
You know, and you look back when we're growing up, you go 50 years back in terms of, let's say 65, you go 50 years back in terms of music, there's nothing recorded that we could say that's, you know, we're listening to as kids. You go now, our kids are listening to the Beach Boys from 50s, 60s all the way up to now.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lot of material.
Yep.
And for a hit to make it now is almost impossible compared to those days because you had limited music, limited output in terms of outlets.
Right. Right. And also it was like, it was huge money, dude.
Oh,
I mean, even like, you know, with the ASCAP, coming back in the publishing and stuff, that that like it always fascinates me, because I got a buddy who's in the music business that, you know, the amount of money that could be made, you know, for different people right. in that world was astounding.
Yeah.
It seems like it was Phil Spector, the Beach Boys, you know, the Birds a bit.
Jan and Dean.
Yeah, Jan and Dean, then Glenn Campbell as a guitar player and as part of the crew, and then his solo career, and then you get into...
Mamas and Papas, that folk right? thing.
And oh, the Herb Albert thing, that was
thing.
That,
Herb, yeah.
That Herb was fucking huge.
Huge.
That, you know, that whole world of that instrumental thing, that type of pop music, which is almost not around anymore, but you know, he went on to become a huge he owned a label, didn't he?
A&M. Him and Jerry Moss started A&M,
and your dad was part of that whole thing.
Yeah, they were, you know, it's the you know one single.
What was it?
I always get these all mixed up.
Your Taste of Honey.
Taste of Honey. Then there's Spanish Flea, and there was Lonely Bull.
Those were huge.
Huge.
Not in my life.
Right. But you're much younger.
Right. But now, so when you're sort of assessing this, like, you know, at what stage in your career and in your life did it become sort of this thing, this, you, I mean, it seems to me that with this documentary, despite the fact that you're working on the productions and everything else, that this was a project of the heart, and you felt
labor of love.
A labor of love.
I love that.
Yeah.
Labor of love, which means it's such a wonderful line, because it means no one else helped. That's what it means.
But also your compulsion was you know, what were your feelings about your father at the time when decided?
It's a great question. It's a great question. It's very interesting, because, you know, people think, oh, yeah, you must have been really close to your father. We were very close, but we fought like motherfuckers.
Yeah.
You know, like any father, son, anything. Anything. It could have been music. It could have been, he would push my button like no one, like a father would.
You the oldest?
No. I have an older brother.
Uh-huh.
But
did he get off the hook, that guy?
Yeah, kind of, because he was, you know, 10 years out, and that's another story. But we were so close, but he knew, as a father-son, we were each other's greatest heroes and also greatest critics.
He couldn't have been judgmental of your career choice.
No, not at all. Very supportive. Yeah. Very, very supportive. It was petty bullshit. So when he was sick...
What happened?
He had lung cancer.
Yeah.
But if you look in the film, every picture, there's a cigarette.
Yeah, sure.
When you're a guitar player and you have a bad reputation of being a smoker, you know you're bad.
Yeah.
You know, they knew where Tommy was here, right? Because the studio was filled with guitar butts. He would constantly three packs a day, cigarette. He didn't drink. He didn't do drugs. Mm-hmm. He didn't like that because he didn't like being out of control.
Mm-hmm.
He was a freak. And I asked my mom about that too. I said... And she said, well, Dad was always paranoid about literally getting arrested and being, he had claustrophobia. So his biggest fear in life was going to be, God help him, in a jail cell.
Yeah.
So he would never drink and drive.
Yeah.
It was freaky.
He didn't drink at all?
He drank when he got home or drink here and there, but not, you know.
Yeah.
But when he got sick, I thought, all right, that's it. Bullshit done. You know, no more fighting.
On your side.
On my side, yeah. Well, even him. I think we all came to, you know, and I had done a small project with a buddy of mine about him, which is where that footage of him in the seminar.
Yeah.
That's where that's from, in the early 80s at Musicians Institute, and Zappa comes from that.
That Zappa bit's great.
And that Zappa line, for those, well, might as well spill it here, is the Zappa line, I took him the piece of my dad in the Gong Show.
Yeah.
My dad was in a tutu, his career
was over.
Right. So what that came about was a running gag in town that Tommy would do this thing called Requiem for a Studio Guitar Player.
Yeah.
And he did it when he was every year winning the Naris Award for Guitar Player. And then all of a sudden Larry Carlton won.
Yeah.
So when they gave Larry the award, he did a skit with Larry who said, you know, in the 50s, I was something. In the 60s, I was a king. 70s rolled out round. I'll do just about anything.
Uh-huh.
So I went to Zappa with that piece, and I thought Zappa was going to be like, you know, funny. Zappa's not funny.
He's intense.
Not. He's intense.
Serious dude.
And I didn't realize that because I didn't obviously know Zappa. But when he said those lines, what he gave me, it was whatever. It was not good. But 30 years later, it was like Frank was giving that to me for 30 years later.
What was the line again? Do you remember?
He says, you know what? Tommy's put up with a lot of shit in this business. So look past the costume and think about blah, blah, blah. Whatever it was. It was kind of like the end of a career, even though it wasn't really the end of my dad's career because he went on for another 20 years doing movies and stuff. But it fit perfectly.
Yeah, yeah. And it was weird because it was just one, it was like a minute.
Yeah, it's like 30, if that. I didn't remember.
But you shot that because I couldn't tell where that was from. I was like, you picked that up?
It was just, no.
You saw him out and you went up to the house or what?
Yeah, I went to Frank's house where it was on Benedict or whatever it was. And
still there.
Yeah. It's still there, right?
Yeah, yeah. And in that basement studio?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember going in there and Frank was like, is your dad coming? Because he was very shy, Frank. He was very quiet. I said, sure. And let me call him, make sure he's on his way, because he wasn't coming. So I said, Dad, you got to get out of here now.
Uh-huh.
You know, it was before cell phones.
Uh-huh.
And so we waited, and Frank's like working in the studio with like two notes on back and forth, reel to reel. And I'm going, what the hell's he doing?
Yeah, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
He was intense.
Yeah. So Tommy showed up?
Yeah. And they were good friends.
They were.
They were actually I have a great bootleg tape. When I say bootleg, it was something that was recorded in a little Sylmar, California. My dad would do this jam session, like once every Wednesday would be guitar
night.
Out in
the desert?
No.
Sylmar?
Sylmar, yeah, the valley.
Yeah.
It was his friend had an Italian restaurant, so he would go there, he'd bring guys in.
Yeah.
You know, sometimes it was Joe Pass, sometimes it was Steve Lukather, or whoever was playing, or that guy.
Yeah.
So one night it was Joe Pass and Frank Zappa and himself. They just came together, and Frank playing jazz with
he was a monster guitar player, dude. Zappa was.
Yeah, but he wasn't a jazz good player compared to Joe Pass.
Sure, sure.
And so Joe's like going, what the fuck is he playing?
Yeah. Shit.
But it was good. It was the relationship, again, is...
They respected each other as musicians.
Exactly.
Because, you know, Frank was a bit of a control freak and, you know...
Right, and my father respected Frank. You know, he did the Lumpy Gravy album.
He did?
Yeah. And that was the first time he met Frank. Well, the first time he knew he met Frank.
Frank brought him in as a session player.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And Frank brought everybody in. And there's a great outtake of Emil Richards, the great vibe, is talking about it. Everybody thought, what is this guy doing?
Yeah.
And then my father looked at the music and was, holy shit.
Yeah.
Because it was going to be hard. It wasn't bullshit. Yeah. So he had it, you know, it's like, because my dad comes dressed up as a Boy Scout thinking he's going to, you know,
be a clown.
And it's like, oh, great.
Yeah, you know, he's like, wrong guy. Gotta learn some-
yeah. You know, so that's what he had to do. He was a constant joker, and that one backfired.
He thought, like, I'm going to walk through this.
Yeah.
And Frank had the notes, like,
no,
layered
exactly.
out.
Yeah, and him and Emil Richards, the Vibus, they had a contest, like, who's going to get through this faster? Let's speed it up, and they kept going.
Well, it's interesting when you listen to some of that Zappa stuff, how, like, elaborate and beyond structure it necessarily was, but, you know, it was orchestrated to the note.
Absolutely. And that's where the fight was started, was like from a French horn player or something. It was like, this is a bunch of shit. And then Emil said, you know, just try playing it. Let's go.
Yeah.
You know.
And did what was the feeling? Did they feel that the piece was like astounding? Or did, like,
no, I don't think one way or another.
Oh, really?
You know what?
It was again, just a tough gig.
Yeah. It's one of those, like, you know, it's not my dad's cup of tea. He doesn't give a shit.
But they remained friends.
Yeah.
Because of respect.
Yeah,
and
very
I think
much
that,
so.
And I think,
and
that,
they
know,
were both
Italian.
Yeah, and they were both non-bullshitters.
Yeah,
you know, they didn't bullshit.
But your feeling was that
I
when your father got sick,
I wanted to make sure. I think maybe deep down, maybe I didn't want him to go.
Sure, of course.
You know, maybe that's why I just kept going. Maybe that's why I haven't finished this doc.
You don't consider it finished yet. It's out.
Well, no, here's what we should make sure everybody knows. It's not out. It's not out, by the way.
I got it in, it looked like it was
no,
a
no,
boxing.
No. What's happened was, all right, so 1996, I start this. I like to say 17 years ago, 17 years younger and 35 pounds lighter.
Uh-huh.
Basically, when I started in 96, Dad got sick, right? He passes away in 97. And right after he passed, I put together a nice 14-minute teaser reel. I got Nancy Sinatra. I got Cher in it at this point. I got everybody going. But no one would touch this damn thing because the music. And they all said...
The licensing.
They said, you got...
Oh, my God, I didn't even think about that.
No, yeah. At that point, now the film's got 120 songs in it.
And what, 90 of them are hits?
Yeah. Oh, no, yeah. 98%, exactly.
Yeah.
So I kept going to everybody, said, you're never going to get the labels and the publishers to agree on this. It's impossible.
Yeah.
Well, I had to keep shooting and go on and carry on.
You have to have the music.
Right. You can't tell the story without it.
Right.
So I, you know, you could talk about it. Well, it was going to be a shit documentary.
Right.
So I kept going and no one would ever jump in. Finally, in 2006, I always talk about crossing that line where you went too far. And my wife thought we just made the most expensive home movie ever.
Yeah.
You know, it was like, in, you know, we've...
How much are you into it for?
Oh, at that point, a couple hundred thousand.
Yeah.
You know, and now, God, I don't even... I cringe. Because yeah. I look at, you know, it's my house.
Yeah.
And so we said, all right, let's make the one jump. Let's go for it. We got to get an editor, a producer, slash. And so I got Claire Scanlon, who was my editor. And we cut this thing.
Yeah.
In 2008, we got into the film festivals.
Yeah.
Did it remarkably well.
Yeah.
Excuse me, easy for a second, I could say. But won a lot of awards, and no one would touch it. But I got...
Couldn't distribute it. But
I couldn't,
you could show it.
I could show it, but I paid for the, you know, festival use.
Yeah.
So then no one would touch it, and I went... And then one of the labels, a publisher says, Denny, you got to renegotiate. Let's do it again. Let's get it lower. Try to get it, because no one's going to touch it. So I went back. Everybody came on. There was one, maybe Putz, that was giving me a problem. But
the publisher?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And but everybody else was cool.
They were
everybody's really into it. And then I had to go back, renegotiate. It took 2 years to get everybody signed off on this. And while
to just give it to you?
No. I'm paying.
Oh, really?
Oh, yeah. I'm still paying. I'm not asking for free. Yeah, I love for free. But no. I'm still paying. I just needed to come back at a more because I have 100 and everybody's on Most Favorite Nation, so if one guy's going to be a jerk, then I got to pay everybody.
But see, this is what baffles me about that is that, you know, this is a historical document,
right,
of
their business.
Music and their business, and if anything, would sell some records, you know, because
I don't give a shit. I agree.
In my mind, it's like, oh, I'm going to go revisit Glen Campbell. I never bought Glen Campbell in my life, and now I got to listen to Glen Campbell.
I know. I've done that,
but they don't.
A lot
think
of people
about
do that. No, because the guy I'm dealing with is the guy that barely has a job still in this business.
Oh, right.
You know what I mean?
He's a department that's sort of like, give him that job in the publishing.
Or he might be the licensing guy, but
licensing
that person,
guy.
He or she. You know, I call back 4 months later, they're gone because, they've cut loose. So it's been that kind of a...
Right.
So once I get everybody signed, and I've been paying as we go along. So I have people were making donations through, IDA, and I would do these fundraising screenings. And sooner or later, I paid it off.
Yeah.
And the last one was Kickstarter, which was a couple months ago. There was one huge bill I needed, which was the Musicians Union.
Yeah.
And I needed to pay these contracts, and I wanted to pay those contracts.
For what?
Because they call it reuse.
Yeah.
If you're going to use these songs in a movie, you got to pay the musicians again, which is fine.
So you got to pay the licensing fee for the publishing.
Masters, the publishing, and the musicians union.
Okay.
This is one of the biggest musicians union contracts ever, any film, because there's over... So they didn't want
120 hit songs.
As much as they wanted, they gave me a great deal, but as much as they wanted... the money, no one wanted to do the work. So that was a long negotiation, whatever. But we got Kickstarter finally came in. I had to go, I needed like $350,000 to really do everything.
Yeah.
And I reached for $250,000 and got $300,000.
Yeah.
So we paid off the Musicians Union.
Okay.
I have a few more songs now. Now I'm hoping to God as we,
You added a few songs?
No, we've paid, we only have a few more songs. I did actually add a couple more since you've seen it.
Yeah.
Don't tell anybody.
Okay.
I'm paying for it. Just don't tell my wife.
Yeah.
But what I had to do is basically I still pay. Now I've only got maybe 4 songs left to pay and I'm done. I'm free, 100% own this thing outright.
Holy shit.
So I played by the rules. I did not. I've not released this film.
And your father would have appreciated that.
Absolutely.
He was a union guy. He got it.
You know what pissed me off?
Yeah.
And I'm going to say it now is my dad did a lot of jazz albums.
Yeah.
Not a lot. I mean, he did whatever, his own personal jazz albums. And he would have said they sold 25 albums maybe all together.
Yeah.
So one of the labels, and I won't mention names.
Okay.
You can figure it out sooner or later. I had a bill of $6,000, a bill of $7,500.
Yeah.
And
for your dad's music?
No.
Okay.
No, for a bunch of music from this one label. And I went, well, I have $6,000 in the bank. I'm going to pay them $6,000. I said, wait, 3 of those songs you guys have in your catalog from my dad's own personal jazz albums.
Uh-huh.
Now, again, you got to realize you don't know my dad's music.
Yeah.
My mom couldn't probably identify those songs.
Yeah.
Unless you're a Tommy Tedesco jazz freak.
Yeah.
Maybe.
Yeah.
You hear it in the background. And I said, do you mind if I get that gratis?
Yeah.
That record guy tore me up, upside down, as if I just insulted his mother.
Yeah.
And that's when I lost respect for that guy.
Yeah.
Because that was the one I was like, dude, you could have given me that.
Yeah.
You know, fine, here's your $1,500 for my dad's music.
Yeah.
You know, yes, you know, he wrote the songs. Yes, it's an album that you didn't even know you had.
Right.
You know, but that's the only time I lost respect for, you know, most. I mean, Herb Alpert's been phenomenal. They've all been phenomenal. I mean, the labels have been, you know, listen, it's hard because I'm not asking, giving them a lot of money. So I'm on the back burner.
There's a licensing fee.
Yes.
So, all right. So why don't we go through, because, you know, I don't know if you have it at the top of your head or if I could find it necessarily. But, you know, starting with as far back as you remember, you know, either songs or albums that you had a license for this thing.
Oh, God. All right. Well, Beach Boys, Good Vibrations.
And they were on the Pet Sounds, the whole Pet Sounds album.
Yeah, the whole Pet Sounds is basically them because that's when Brian was doing his own thing.
There's some fascinating stuff in the doc about that.
Yeah. See, Brian, well, the thing is, Brian, you know, and I actually interviewed Dean Torrance of Jan and Dean last month, and he told me how that all came about.
Yeah.
He said what happened was Jan and Dean were doing their thing.
Yeah.
Brian Wilson, or the Beach Boys, were their opening act, like on this, one of those, you know, the rock and roll tours.
Yeah.
So they were doing, like, they were like the house band in a sense, and they would play with all these acts coming through.
The Beach Boys. Yeah.
So Jan and Dean did their thing, which was a doo-wop thing.
Yeah.
And then they came short on time or whatever, and then they had to go back out, and Jan and Dean started singing Beach Boy songs with the guys.
Yeah.
So they had a relationship.
Right.
All of a sudden, Brian gives them, I can't remember the song, whatever it was. Jan and Dean has this huge hit with it, one of Brian's songs. Brian sees, he walks into the studio and sees all these studio musicians, and Jan says, Brian, you could do this. You just hire these guys. They just come and they show up and they do your music and you walk away. You don't have to have the brothers and all that do it all.
Yeah.
And so Brian was like, yeah.
Yeah.
And so it was easier for Brian to deal with musicians.
Yeah.
Then probably family.
And also to execute his vision.
Exactly.
Yeah. Because, like, you know, when they were talking about Brian, all of them, you know, Carol and your father, it seemed that they were like, this kid had something.
Yeah, and they didn't know what, but it was like, he's got something that's different.
But his arrangements defied their sort of understanding a little bit.
And I don't think they knew that until after they heard it.
Uh-huh.
And that was the weird thing. It's not like, because it didn't...
Oh, right. Who was talking about that? Good Vibration. Was it Glenn Campbell?
Glenn Campbell. When he first heard it, he was like, wow.
What?
Because it was all pieced together.
Yeah.
Brian was piecing it together.
And he heard Good Vibrations on the car radio, and he's like, oh my God. Yeah. I had no idea.
And Leon Russell, in the interview I did with him recently, he said, Brian Wilson is one of the greatest guys, greatest...
Composers
ever. And that's coming from Leon. And Leon said... He would go around the room and tell each guy what he wanted to play.
Yeah.
And he said, by the time he got back to the beginning, the first guy forgot it, but he'd tell him again.
Yeah.
And you know, he had his shit together.
Right.
And it was really cool, you know, Leon's praising, you know, Brian.
All right, so all that Beach Boy stuff. Now, the Phil Spector stuff is another whole catalog of stuff that your dad and those guys
Phil
were involved
Spector, in. And that was, then I had to deal with that over the years because then Phil, you know.
Before he got in trouble.
Well, This is way before he got in trouble. You know, to get Phil stuff was going to be hard in itself. But then all of a sudden, Phil kills the girl.
Yeah.
Now it's like, great. No, there's nothing. There's no. And I
so
was
he
trying,
had so he had possession of his whole catalog.
Yeah.
Okay.
So and I was always trying to get
holy shit. So he's still making a fortune.
Well, he sold a lot of it off to pay for the bills.
Yeah.
But I was trying to get a hold of, you know, I was trying to get Phil for years
to talk to you.
Yeah. I mean, before all this shit.
Yeah.
You know, and Phil was very, you know, instrumental.
Yeah.
You know, and these guys, you know.
Well, that, you know, what was interesting about that is it seemed that Phil, that all these guys who come from a big band background or a jazzbo background, you know, were now involved in, you know, an orchestral sort of setting that was completely unique to them. That, you know, they all had experience with sitting on a bandstand with 20 guys or 15 guys or however many.
Right.
But now there's 30 guys in a room and they're doing popular rock music. Right. So that, you know, I guess it's hard to really
Because you think they just thought of it as any other music. I don't
another
think they
gig,
were, yeah.
Right? But I mean, but at some point, it'd be interesting to know, because I know that even when they talked about it, your father and whoever was talking about it, you're like, this guy was running us. You know, it was really about the time and the exhaustion,
right.
And whether they were getting it right, or you know, and one guy, yeah. I guess, which guitar
Howard
player?
Howard Roberts.
Howard Roberts was so, like, "Fuck this,"
yeah. And that was because, which is interesting because Phil was a frustrated guitar player. He wanted to be a jazz guitar player.
Oh, really?
That's why he surrounds himself with Howard Roberts, my father, Barney Kessel, Bill Pittman. They're all jazz guitar players in this group,
uh-huh.
in a sense.
Yeah.
And so when Howard Roberts actually was teaching Phil.
Yeah.
So now all of a sudden, Phil's telling Howard, the greatest jazz guitar player around, to how to play. Howard said, "Fuck you.
Yeah,
I'm done."
Yeah.
You know,
and I walked.
Yeah.
And then the other guys were like, that's kind of, we don't want to lose our gig.
We just keep going, you know.
But it's interesting, you don't get any sense from any of the people that, because I didn't see it in the documentary either, that, you know, they were such sort of like, you know, kind of working class people who had a job that they loved. But you don't get there was a couple of moments, I think, with Carol and Brian Wilson, where you get this sense of like, wow, we were really part of something amazing.
Only after years later.
Uh-huh.
Only after you... Yeah, like I said, I asked all of them, I said, was there any intimidation or were you, you know, by these artists? And they said, no, the only, not intimidation, but the time you're ever going to be right on is when you go get that call for Sinatra.
Yeah.
Because you realize everybody these guys are working for, Brian.
Yeah.
And all these other guys, they're kids.
Yeah.
They're nobody. They're not hit makers yet.
No one's
a hit maker.
Well, I mean, before Pet Sounds, they'd had a couple.
But it's not real. You know,
it
what
was
I mean?
Just it was like bubblegum
music.
Yeah.
But when you get a call for Sinatra, that's right. When you call him back to Niagara Falls and say, "Mom, I'm playing with Frank."
You know,
Gambino family back there is excited for you.
Yeah.
You know, that kind of like that was the only time they were like, okay.
Yeah.
But you know, like my father said, he said, "Listen, I might have." You know, if someone said, "Don't you think you should have been paid more for, let's say, adding your arrangements or this and that or those notes and da-da-da?" He said, "No." He said, "You know, I go to work." He says, "Don't forget, I made hundreds of hits, but I made thousands of bombs."
Yeah.
He says, "I never gave anybody their money back on a bomb."
Right.
It's just what it is.
But really that question is, don't you think you should have been cut into the publishing money?
No, because I think they tried at some point, but I think it's like one of those things where, what are you going to do? Hold back on creativity?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're not going to give that line because you think it's a great line in your act. You know what I mean? Because you're giving it to the other guy. You know?
Yeah.
It's all your artists are. You know, they're working together. Hopefully.
What was the riff? Was that the Howard thing? Was that Spanish riff? Was that the
no?
Peggy
that's my dad's.
Right. Well, what was that song? What song was that from?
Oh, he used to do. The gag was my dad.
Oh no, not the gag. But there was a guitar part. Who was talking about
it? Oh, that was Gary Lewis and the Playboys.
Yeah, Gary Lewis and the Playboys.
Right. They're sure going to love you.
Yeah, right. Yeah, Tommy had done this riff and they couldn't play it live on stage, right?
Right. Because he would, you know, again, you listen to, that's the difference. You listen to those guys of certain caliber and you've seen it. You play guitar, but you know when you see a guitar player that's a monster, you go, you put it down.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You go, ooh, you cringe thinking about it. And that's what these guys were. Those were the guys, the monsters that would make the other guys cringe.
Yeah.
So that's why when they might have been pissed off in the studio when they're watching someone else record their parts, but then they realize why they're recording their parts.
Right.
You understand.
Right.
And then they found a newfound respect for the guys behind the glass, you know,
Well, they made the hit. Now you just got to go service it.
Yeah.
And if you don't service it in the same way, who gives a shit? Yeah. It's a live show and they're there to see.
That's it. And that's what people didn't understand is like, well, how could they play, you know, how could the Beach Boys and all these groups play in concert? They had weeks to practice.
Sure. And they just got to
sound sucked.
Yeah.
Could you imagine recording some of those concerts?
Yeah.
They'd be here forever and torturing us.
What's interesting to me in terms of your experience with this, you know, and obviously, you know, you've got all this music, you got the Phil Spector stuff. What was the Frank Sinatra thing? What did your father's experience with Frank Sinatra?
Oh, well, you know, he did actually work with Frank a few times. Strangers in the Night was, you know, the big one that he did with Frank, you know, that he remembers.
Uh-huh.
Or that he was there. You know, was the special one.
Yeah.
Even though, but you know, it's funny because Bill Pittman, again, back to King Salt, thought it was a piece of shit song.
Yeah.
And so did Frank. Nancy said her dad hated that song, Strangers in the Night, which is really interesting. My dad, I remember playing a casual. A casual, for those that don't know, is basically, it's like a wedding or whatever.
Right.
and he did Frank's Wedding, and I can't remember, it would have been Mia Farrow, maybe?
Maybe.
It was basically him, his trio.
Yeah.
Three guys at a dinner party of 10.
Oh, really?
Could you imagine what that's like?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, you know, working with Frank, you rehearsed all day. Not all day, whatever. You rehearsed for a few hours, Frank come in, and boom, knock out 1-2 takes.
Yeah.
You know.
Did your father love him?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, because I think maybe being an Italian kid, also, he said there was no better singer.
Yeah.
For him.
Yeah.
You know, that was, and you talk to those singers of, even like, you know, I've talked to a few people, said that guy's intonation was just, forget it.
Yeah, yeah.
It was a natural.
Uh-huh. Who else did your father, like, respect?
Respected, oh, God, that's a tough one. Yeah. It's funny, because he played with Elvis.
Yeah.
You know, he always loved, he liked Sam Cooke.
Yeah.
He liked Sam Cooke.
Yeah, yeah.
He played with Marvin Gaye, but Sam Cooke, he thought was, he liked him as a better singer.
I just got a Sam Cooke album. I wonder if I just saw that. Was that your dad's?
No, no, but Hal's on that, though. And Renee Hall, Renee Hall's, that's the one with, oh, God, what's it called? I saw that in your collection.
Yeah, I just got it. I just got it sealed. I didn't know it was sealed. I wanted to get a bunch of records. A guy gave me a sealed records, and I got a collector's item in there, and I don't know if I can fucking open it to listen to it.
Oh, who cares? Just open it.
Yeah.
Just listen to it. Yeah, yeah. What are you going to do?
Yeah, I know.
Make $10 more?
Yeah, you're right. Like, you're absolutely right. So, like, all right, so that's right. I forgot about the Sam Cooke part. It's just astounding to me. And Hal Blaine, you got such a gift with that guy living.
Oh,
I tell you, man, what a character.
He is outright gone. I mean, he's just,
drummer. But he is the drummer.
The drummer. I mean, you had him and Earl Palmer. The difference is Earl is a little older. So Earl comes out of New Orleans with, you know, Little Richard
that groove,
and all that groove. And then Hal starts up, and when Hal, Earl's too busy, he starts giving it to Hal. Then Hal's going, and Earl's going, and they're doing double drums on Jan and Dean, and they're going back, you know, doing it all together. And there's no jealousy. That's the greatest thing, because there's no jealousy when there's so much work.
Yeah.
You know?
Right.
And my dad would
but
do
But they
it.
Must love it when they're in it, the groove, and
oh,
just hitting
yeah.
it. I mean,
yeah, yeah.
I mean, I got to imagine that the no matter how much they frame it as, like, we got jobs, when they're on a groove and they nail it, they must be like, holy fuck.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. And, you know, and Hal was on 6 records of the year.
What, do you know which ones?
It would have been...
I know the Captain and Tennille was the last one.
The last one, that's 7. But it would have been Taste of Honey, Up, Up and Away, Aquarius, Bridge Over Troubled Water, and Mrs. Robinson. Wow, did I nail it?
Yeah,
I think
maybe.
So. But, like, Up, Up and Away, there's an example of where my father didn't know he was on it.
Yeah.
And the only reason he knew was Jimmy Webb gave all the guys little charms, like Grammy charms.
Yeah.
And he said to Hal, what was this for? He says, that's that thing we did with Bones and da da da. And it was that Fit Dimension thing we did last year. Because now you realize you're making
what's
a.
What's this for? They doing that much?
I don't know what this is for. I don't know I'm on that. Can you imagine? You don't know what you're on.
Because you're working so much.
Working so much, but you're only there for 3 hours. They're giving you music you've never heard before.
Yeah.
No one's ever heard it.
And maybe the vocal track isn't even on it.
Vocal track's not on that.
Oh, see, yeah.
So all you're playing is some rhythm tracks.
Yeah.
So you're laying down the tracks, walking away.
Yeah.
Boom. Forget it.
Yeah.
Months later, comes out, you're not listening.
Right.
You're not listening.
See, I didn't even factor that in. So you're not sitting there going like, we're doing a song for the Fifth Dimension.
No.
No, you got a 3-hour session.
They might tell you, or the singer might be there.
Who doesn't matter. You put the cans on. There's a drum. There's a bass, and you got your music in front of you. You knock it out, and you're out.
Yeah. So they didn't know a lot of times. It's funny because sometimes a lot of these guys, you know, and a lot of these people, as I like to say, they think they did a lot more shit than they did. Now, as my father said, here's the thing. He says the people we're talking about, they weren't on the fringes.
Yeah.
They worked. My dad went to work at 8 o'clock in the morning and sometimes never came home.
Yeah.
Because if he had a gig at the same studio the next morning, you know what? I'll stay here.
Oh, sleep in the studio.
Yeah. Or they play cards all night.
Oh, yeah.
They were gamblers.
Yeah. That was their thing.
That was their thing. Bad.
But really bad?
Yeah.
Like what? Lose that house bad?
It was bad enough to where it was like he'd bet on anything.
That was his thing.
He did anything. It could have been, you know.
Yeah.
And, you know, that was his thing.
That caused friction at home?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And it's funny, though. When he kind of got sick, he had a stroke. What happened was, and you'll appreciate this for all of us, is why I think the film has done so well with audiences. There's different reasons. You all know the music. And that's easy. That's 50% of the story. And that's piece of cake.
Yeah.
And this is all by accident.
Yeah.
there's two things going on in this story. One, it's about a group of musicians, you know, where you were in the thick of it and you're just kicking ass and nothing's stopping you. And my question to all these guys, what happens when you're not the A-team anymore? When you are, you know, it's like, you know,
at that juncture in the late 60s.
The late 60s, yeah. Or whatever, whenever it is for anybody. For my dad, it was the late 80s.
Yeah.
Because he went from 60s records and 70s into TV and film.
Yeah, he had a hell of a
huge
career there.
Career in film and stuff, like you saw in the... And so what happened is I asked Bones how, and these are my two favorite lines, is Bones, the great producer engineer, said, you're like an athlete.
Yeah.
You got your 10 years in the minors, whatever, you got your, and you're at the top, and then you got the ramp down. He says, it's not staying at the top. It's taking the ramp down as long as possible.
Yeah.
And that's for all of us. And you don't have to be a comedian, a musician, an actor. You could be a lawyer. You could be a postman. Yeah. We all want to be part of something in our society.
Right.
We just want to be, we want you relevant. That's the word. Thank you. And that was the thing. And the other question I had about it, and for everybody, was how did all going to work 24/7 affect your personal lives? Now, Hal, he was married 6 times.
Yeah.
You know, as he's
one got him though, huh?
Yeah.
One
got him.
Poor guy.
As my father said, do you remember that line in my father's house as well? It affected me. I had 6 wives. And my father said, yeah, but it wasn't because of your drumming. It was your personality.
Yeah.
But I asked everybody, and Plaz, the Johnson, the wonderful sax man and legend who did the Pink Panther and stuff, he said, and he paused and he said, you know what? I'm a better grandfather than a father.
Yeah.
And again, if you're a parent, you understand instantly because you're trying like hell to make this work and it's never going to make it right.
And also that generation was different.
Exactly.
I mean, the work ethic was like, I just got to provide.
Exactly.
The other stuff, maybe that'll happen, maybe it won't.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah.
It's true. And, you know, thank God for my mother. God bless her. I mean, she kept it together at home.
Still around?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Yeah. She's 83.
You got kids?
Yeah, 2.
How old?
Isabella's 15 and Raphael's 9.
So they didn't know him?
No, but all they know is Wrecking Crew. That's all they know is Daddy does Wrecking Crew and they're sick of it.
But okay, so let's say, you know, for you, you know, was, you know, when your father's dying, when someone has a prolonged cancer, you at least you have time to process the grief at the time. I mean, what did this serve your relationship, you know, as he was dying and then afterwards? I mean, because you have a growing relationship with your father, you know, 15 years after he's dead.
Yeah. You know what? I've never been asked that, but it's really interesting. I think what the thing I'm proudest of, and it's not about the movie, but the people I've met, you know, around the country, guitar players, and people that are strangers to me, but they met him. Uh-huh. They met him, let's say, at a seminar in Rochester, or they met him in this, or, you know, and they couldn't say anything. The stories that come back of how nice he was or what he did for them. Chuck Rainey was a wonderful, one of the greatest bass players of all time. Uh-huh. And he told me a story about, and he was in the, you know, rock and roll stuff and this, you know, Steely Dan and all that stuff. And he said, I came to town, he says, in the 70s. I'm the big rock and roll studio guy, and I'm on a TV date.
Yeah.
He says, you know, that's totally different.
Yeah.
You know, you're a studio musician. Yeah, everybody's a studio musician, quote unquote.
Yeah.
But you're not, until you get to this certain position, you'll go, oh, shit, I got to do this.
Yeah.
Things change. Records are different than TV. TV's different than film.
Yeah.
He says, I'm playing this part and it's an odd time for me on the bass. And all of a sudden I have to make a change in the time, bass time. He says, I blow it during rehearsal. I'm like, And he says, so now we're going again. And he says, all of a sudden now we're rolling. It's just TV. You know, they got the projector rolling, everything going, big band. And he says, I blow it. And all of a sudden your father comes out of nowhere with his guitar and just makes a huge noise.
Yeah.
You know, screws up. I said, Tommy, you okay? Yeah, I'm fine. All right, let's do it again.
Yeah.
And so Chuck says, we go again. He says, they come to that piece again, the measure, and I'm blowing it again.
Yeah.
Your father again, bam, even louder, makes an even bigger noise. Tommy, what's up? You know, I'm fine. This is it. Let's do it. Roll back the film. And he said, your father turned to me and says, you're on your own now. You know, he covered him. And now he didn't even know they had never met.
Yeah.
But he knew he was the new guy.
Yeah.
And he would protect the new guy.
Yeah.
you know, and he, and that to me was, when they talk about certain
people. Did the guy nail it?
No, you know, that's funny you ask, because I asked the same thing.
Yeah.
I said, Chuck, what did you do? He says, I didn't play. He says, I let out, he says, and my father afterwards at the break, he says, that's what you're supposed to do the first time. He says, he says, look around the studio. He yelled at him. He says, they're all in the bass line. Everybody's playing. No one's going to hear you.
Yeah.
He says, so he was, that was the lesson. He could, you know, and
yeah.
And that was the thing. He was, he protected so many people. And, you know, drummers would tell the same thing. The Placido Domingo album, a Latin thing, and the producer was out of hand, and they, he was getting out of hand. My father said, at the break, took him outside, said, listen, motherfucker, if you don't cool out, we're all leaving.
Yeah.
You know, he said, that's it. Don't talk to these people. He had such disrespect for people that talk to musicians badly.
Uh-huh.
And he could do it because he was the older guy.
Yeah. Yeah.
He was, and yeah. And it's like, don't talk bad to musicians. And, you know, sometimes I, you know, and he would, the one thing he taught me, don't blow it with the leader.
Yeah.
If you want to tell off the leader, the producer, whatever you want, that's fine. You could be 120% right, but don't expect to come back tomorrow.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah.
And
yeah.
It was, and that's kept me going on this project 17 years uh-huh. because those people I wanted to tell off 15 years ago when they want to give me something, well, they're back, they're still around and they need to help me.
Uh-huh.
So it's helped.
So you didn't fucking burn any bridges?
Not yet.
Yeah.
I only got a couple more months.
What about your relationships with the guys that knew your father, which I imagine became very deep, you know, through this process with like Hal. Or
Hal and Don Randy, you know, and Glenn was phenomenal.
He's an interesting guy, Glenn Campbell.
Yeah, and very interesting. And that was the greatest thing is the other great thing about doing this doc, when I started it, it was 17 years ago.
And you're like, it's Tommy's kid.
Right.
Yeah.
And I'm asking questions that he's never been asked.
Who, Tommy?
No, Glenn.
Right.
You know, I'm talking about the days of session players. This is, you know, 10 years ago, whatever it was, before Alzheimer's. He had something going. We knew there was something when my interview.
Oh, he's
interview,
got Alzheimer's?
Oh, big time.
Oh,
yeah,
really?
He's gone.
Oh.
It's sad. It's very sad. He's stopped touring. He's just, but when I was asking him questions, it was questions that he'd never been asked.
Uh-huh.
And that to him was the greatest time period of his life.
Yeah.
Because he wasn't the leader.
Before he became a solo act.
Before he became solo act.
Yeah.
You know, the first time he came back from Europe doing a tour or something, he came back and go through the airport and someone said, hey, Glenn, how's it going? And going, how's everybody know me? Because it was the season replacement for the Smothers Brothers.
Right.
So that was that one time and the Smothers Brothers got canceled, so they just kept him going.
Yeah. And with Hal Blaine.
It was back to Hal. The guy, if he wasn't a musician, he would have been a comedian.
Yeah.
You know, he was friends with Lenny Bruce and, you know. And
we started in the burlesque and he covered
all that absolutely.
Stuff.
And, I mean, you know, you go out to, no matter what you do, you could go anywhere. Something's going to light up a light bulb for a second, you know.
Yeah.
You'd be in a deli and all of a sudden a deli joke comes out or comes out. It's nonstop. I don't know how he knows so much, so many jokes.
Yeah.
I mean, ridiculous.
Yeah. And he's still all there?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He's there.
So what are we going to do, Danny? What are we
going to do? So now I basically, what I'm doing is I got to get this thing out. Distributors wouldn't touch me because it was like, you know, no one wanted to touch it because of the music.
Now it's all paid for.
I'm paid for it. You know, so I'm just hoping to get this thing out there.
Yeah.
I'm doing fundraisers. I'm doing private screenings. I've shown this film all around the world.
Well, where can people who are listening to this go and help out?
Basically, go to the website, wreckingcrewfilm.com. And, you know, if you're a distributor out there, why haven't you called? You know, I've paid it now. Let's go. It's funny. The greatest thing for me was showing this film.
Yeah.
To live audiences. And we've had it as fundraisers for different groups and, you know, foster care and different things. And, I'm proud of the film. I'm really proud of the new cut too that no one's seen. So,
and do you feel like on some level that, you know, it sounds like your relationship with your father wasn't horrible, and you
no, not at all.
But do you feel that you have that was something compelling you around, like, not unlike you say your father looked out for the new guy and for the musician and for you know for the respect of his profession.
Yeah.
Do you feel like, you know, as a son that, you know, you're sort of, you know, not only
carrying
showing
it on?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not
wow.
Only,
I got goosebumps. You're right. You know what? I never thought of it that way, but I just, when I think about it, yeah. Because I get really, And it's so weird that you said it, because I'm just thinking about this. Like, yes, you're right. I do. Because I have such respect for these musicians.
Yeah.
The hardest thing for me is watching musicians are so talented.
Yeah.
Or comics are so talented. Or actors are so talented. It's a matter of luck sometimes.
Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
You know, and it's so funny because I've said this, and traveling this thing with this film, I only got a briefcase and a film with me, a backpack. You know, and I'm doing one-nighters here and there, and go, how the hell do you guys do this shit?
Yeah.
You know, how do the musicians do it with the gear and the comics? And, you know, the difference is, you know, hopefully I have, you know, it's a film. It's not as, it's passive, you know.
Yeah.
It's not interactive like you have to do it.
Yeah.
Like, I couldn't imagine that.
Yeah.
But it is having the respect. I want them to have the respect in people that know.
Yeah.
You know, and my father was, you know, if you ever saw him play live, for any of those people out there that saw him play live, you know, you go, he's ripping through. And my mom would say, why are you doing that? He'd be like, he says, it's for the one guitar player in the room, you know. The greatest, you know, I got to tell you this funny story is, you know, years ago when I was producing for, I did those Pulp Comics things on Comedy Central.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
What was the angle on Pulp Comics?
Pulp Comics was doing the stand-up, and we would cut to a film about
whatever that was.
So I did Margaret Cho, I did Bobcat, I did Dana Gould.
You were shooting it?
No, I was producing it. And I was producing the film parts. So my first time was with Bobcat, and Bobcat writes, who's actually one of the smartest guys I've ever
met. He directed eight of my episodes.
He's amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so cool. I mean, so I go to, you know, meet with Bob. Can we do all this shit? And I'm finding a location. Of course, Bobcat writes in a porno store on Van Nuys Boulevard. So I'm going to the porno store and making agreements, to shoot there with his crew. And this, and I give him the guy my card. He goes, any relation to Tommy? And I'm going, God, I hope he's a guitar player. Don't tell me my dad shops here. Those are the kind of things.
And was he a guitar player?
Yeah, thank God. But it was one of those things, you know, and that happens a lot. And I'm really, you know, again, those articles were really popular, and he told it like it was.
Yeah. Well, thank you for bringing me the Tommy Tedesco for Guitar Players Only book. I need this. What is it? Shortcuts and Techniques, Sight Reading, and Studio Playing.
And you know what? Drummers tell me they used to read that book. It had nothing to do, but there's stories in between that were pretty funny.
Does it teach you how to read music?
Yeah. I tried the other day. It still hasn't helped me, but I got to practice. Everybody assumes I can play guitar, but I haven't gotten the third chord down. So,
in my mind, I'm like, I'm going to do this.
That's what I do all the time. I'm going to learn how to play guitar. I'm 53.
It might not happen.
It's got to. I wanted it to be like the side story of this documentary.
Of you learning how to play guitar.
Well, I said to one of the friends, you know, a professional, I said, if I did 50% of or 10% of what I put into this documentary practicing, I'd be a hell of a guitar player.
Yeah.
He said, yeah, but you'd be out of work like the rest of us.
Yeah. So whatever. But you got your old man's guitars or what?
Yeah, there's still a few of them home.
Yeah?
Yeah.
That's
so
nice.
I still try.
All right, well, thanks, Danny.
Thank you,
great
I really talking. Appreciate
that's
it.
Great.
Thank
that's
you.
Great. All right, that's our show, folks. Thank you for listening. Since Denny and I spoke, I wanted to tell you this, and after 18 years in production, there is finally a distributor that wants to release the film. They're targeting a release date in 2015, so we'll keep in touch with Denny and let you know how that progresses. Go to WTFpod.com and get that app and upgrade to that premium app. Stream all the episodes. Thank you for listening. Watch Marin tonight to watch me relive one of the most traumatic experiences of my life. Thank you for bearing witness. Thank you for being there today, especially today. I think I unburdened myself. I don't know. The heart's a funny thing. The mind's a funny thing. But that's about it, though. I don't think there's anything else that I haven't really talked to you guys about. God damn. Life is a fucking trip, man. Boomer lives!